Les colloques du Collège de France.
Thank you, Denis, and thank you for including me in this lineup. We had a really wonderful day talking about how our genomes are organized at the local level with nucleosomes that modulate DNA accessibility, but also at the more global level, forming TADs and allowing long-range contacts for regulation. I think in this last session with Justin and I, we're now focusing on the DNA sequence, this beautiful four-letter alphabet that nature invented to encode essentially all of life, and also the development of complex organisms such as our bodies, specifying differential gene expression and allowing the development of all these distinct cell types and organs. And I will focus on, in particular, on enhancer sequences that, as we learn today, are distal regulatory elements that essentially drive gene expression in these highly cell type specific patterns. We heard a lot about enhancers, but I want to review two key properties, namely that enhancers can be necessary for transcription, as shown here at this sonic hedgehog limb enhancer that you might remember from the second talk today by Wendy, where if you delete the enhancer from the genomic locus of mice, then you lose sonic hedgehog expression in the developing limb buds and develop mice that lack limb structures. So this classical genetic loss of function experiment indicates necessity in this case for the sonic hedgehog enhancer. But a second property I find even more fascinating, and it actually underlies most of what I'm going to talk about today, and that is that enhancers can also be sufficient to drive gene expression patterns. Namely, if you clone the enhancer out of its endogenous genomic context and bring it together with a heterologous promoter and the reporter gene, the expression of which you can visualize, such as GFP or, as in this example, LAC-Z, then this short DNA sequence outside its chromatin and sequence context can recapitulate the gene expression of the native gene, indicating A, sufficiency for gene expression, but also that somehow this gene expression pattern must be encoded in the enhancer's DNA sequence. And that is not an isolated example, but in fact, by now we have hundreds of examples where enhancers like these have been tested in transgenic mouse embryos, in this case, to drive autonomously gene expression patterns. And it's exactly these sequences here, as I print them on this slide, that reproducibly and robustly drive gene expression in the forebrain, the neural tube, the somites, and the limbs of mouse embryos. But we, interestingly, we cannot, from the sequence, predict which enhancer would be active in which tissue, nor whether a particular DNA sequence would be active at all. And several speakers today already alluded to this fact that we have such a hard time finding or predicting enhancers in the genome. And this inability to understand the sequence-to-function relationship for enhancers also means that we typically cannot interpret the functional outcome of sequence mutations within enhancers, namely, for example, whether this enhancer would be stronger, weaker, or potentially shut off at all. And it is, again, this one enhancer, the sonic hedgehog limb enhancer, for which, when mutated, many aberrations are known, both in human patients, as shown here, but also, as Wendy showed in the morning, for example, in cats or chicken. So I found this relationship between enhancer DNA sequences and their regulatory activity totally fascinating. And the vision of our group is to work with reductionist approaches where we directly test the gene regulatory potential of different DNA sequences to elucidate the rules that might be governing this relationship. And as you can imagine, it's probably impossible, or at least very hard, to deduce any rules from individual examples, but we reasoned about 16 years ago now, when I moved to Vienna, that we might actually be able to deduce rules more statistically if we had just sufficiently many examples. And for this, we didn't work with mice, but for, I guess, ethical and financial reasons, switched to my favorite model organism, the the Drosophila fruit fly, and in particular to Drosophila fruit fly embryos. And the vision was to characterize as many enhancer sequences as possible. And this was a huge task that Evgeny Kwon, the first PhDs in the lab, took on, again, almost 15 years ago by now, where in collaboration with the Barry Dixon lab, he cloned and tested more than 7,700, about 2 kb DNA sequences that tiled a large part, about 21 megabases of the Drosophila genome, and subjected each of these sequences individually to such reporter assays with a constant promoter and reporter integrated into a constant genomic landing site. And then for each of these sequences determined whether it was an enhancer and in which tissue it was active. Here I show you the central nervous system of the fly embryo, or whether it was not active during embryogenesis at all. If we look at the raw data, I think it's really beautiful because we can, for individual gene loci, like the thrombospondin gene here, essentially explain gene expression, which is here on the left of this line, by the activity of the different enhancers that we tested, such that at early embryos 7-8, we have this single intronic enhancer that explains this simple expression patterns. But then if we go to later stages of embryogenesis, you see how highly dynamic gene expression is over development, and also how at each stage you have basically the additive activity of different enhancers that come together to explain the overall gene expression pattern. So a highly dynamic, if you go top to bottom, activity throughout development, and at each stage going left to right, you see this additivity where different enhancers come together to produce a more complex gene expression pattern. And overall, this work led to a great resource where, for again, more than 7,700 DNA sequences, we had now their enhancer activities. 46% of them were active in very diverse patterns, such as those that you see in the background of this slide, from very simple stripe-like enhancers in early embryogenesis to later enhancer activities that trace entire organ systems, again, like, for example, the central nervous system enhancer. And now the cool thing is that all of these results come from extremely well-controlled experiments, where for every one of these images or enhancer activities, we know the underlying 2KB sequence. Meaning we could then computationally establish similarities between enhancers that had similar or identical patterns, and thereby essentially map the association between transcription factor motifs that you see here lined up along the x-axis, and whether or not they were found enriched in enhancers active in different organ systems. And this simple association analysis alone recapitulated essentially decades of fly genetics, finding contributions of the TRL or GAGA transcription factors to CNS enhancers, serpent and other GATA factors to gut, Pani and Tinman motifs were enriched in enhancers of the dorsal vessel, that's the fly's heart, and so forth. And these predictions that the respective motifs that are enriched in the different enhancer classes might also be functionally important were also tested by Evgeny. And here I show you only two examples where in 3 out of 3 different midgut enhancers, mutating this short GATA motif led to a loss of enhancer activity. And similarly, in 4 out of 4 different central nervous system enhancers, the mutation of these TRL or GAGA motifs again led to a loss of enhancer activity. So this was work done more than a decade ago, published in 2014, and at that time we got really good at destroying enhancers. So we could predict which motifs might be important for enhancers of particular types, of particular tissues, and we could mutate these motifs and indeed typically destroy the enhancer activity. But we could not at the time use this knowledge and piece together these motifs to create functional enhancers from scratch, which was extremely frustrating. And in fact, the group walked away from these problems for a few years. Until now, more recently, artificial intelligence came to the lab in form of a PhD student, Bernardo Almeida, who suggested that we could potentially use these very powerful machine learning tools that you're all familiar with that come to us in the form of, for example, ChatGPT or celebrated successes in protein folding with AlphaFold. And I agreed that this would be worth a try, whether these advanced models could potentially help decipher this very complex enhancer coding rules. But there was just one problem, and that problem is that you need extremely large amounts of data to train these models. The more complex the model, the more data you need for training. And so we initially, rather than working with these embryonic enhancers, of which we had only a few thousand, we initially switched to a different way of finding and functionally characterizing enhancers. And this is Starseq, a genome-wide enhancer activity assay developed by Cosmas Arnold when he was a PhD student in the lab, where the trick or the key insight of the method was to move the enhancer or the enhancer candidate from this position upstream of the promoter to a position inside the transcribed region, so essentially into the 3' GR of the promoter of the reported gene, such that active enhancers would essentially stimulate their own transcription, and we could measure enhanced activity by the levels of which we could recover enhanced RNA in among the cellular RNA. This direct coupling of enhancer sequence to activity in cis on the same molecule, coupled that you can do this on plasmid in extremely high throughput, allows genome-wide screens of enhancer activities in cell lines that are easily transfectable. And here, for example, for the Drosophila S2 cell, you see a typical raw Starseq data track that looks very similar to ChIP-seq or ATAC-seq data. But now these peak heights quantitatively correspond to enhancer activity or strength of the underlying sequence. And so the cool thing about this method now is, while it's only applicable to individual cell lines one at a time, it gives us essentially genome-wide functional data on whether a particular DNA sequence is an enhancer and how strong it is. So this is perfect training data for these types of machine learning methods. And so Bernardo Almeida, this new PhD student that brought AI to the lab, decided to build a convolutional neural network that he called DeepStar to directly model the relationship between the DNA sequence and developmental or housekeeping type enhancer activity. And for this, he basically fed the model with the one hot encoded raw DNA sequence, ran convolutional filters that essentially detect local sequence features such as transcription factor motifs, and then fed them into the neural network part of the model, where two fully connected layers learned the weights and the importance of the different sequence features towards enhancer activities. And together with Franziska Reiter, another PhD student who redid Starseq for these two transcriptional programs in S2 cells, and they could show that this model can learn enhancer activities or can predict enhancer activities from the DNA sequence extremely well. So here you see a short region of the genome from a part of the genome that we do not use for training, so this so-called leave one out or left out test part of the data set. And you can see how the experimentally observed enhancer activities are extremely well recapitulated by the computational predictions for both the developmental and the housekeeping programs. And across this entire test set, we obtain Pearson correlation coefficient, so a quantitative agreement of about 0.7. So we were basically for the first time able to directly quantitatively predict enhancer activities from the DNA sequence. But that success was not the most exciting thing, but rather that we could now have a completely new look at enhancers. So previously, we started enhancers like this. We looked at the DNA sequences, and we were able to highlight motifs such as these GADA motifs that I highlight here in bold font. But now, with model interpretation tools such as DeepLift from, for example, the Anshul Kundaji group, we can now, for every nucleotide along the enhancer sequence, measure its contribution to the model's predictions, or in other words, its contribution to enhancer activity. And one of the first surprises that came out was that these seemingly identical looking GADA motifs, and you look at the DNA sequence, had apparently entirely distinct contributions to enhancer activity, with motif 2 being the strongest, motif 1 having some kind of intermediate contribution, and motif 3 having almost no contribution at all. This was so surprising that Bernardo and Fanny went back to the lab and tested this experimentally, and indeed, compared to the wild-type enhanced activity shown here in red, mutating instance 3 had almost no drop in activity. Mutating instance 1 halved the activity approximately, while mutating instance 2 led to a complete collapse of enhanced activity, essentially validating the predictions of the model. And this was not only true for this one enhancer, but it was actually true across about 1,000 GADA motif instances in several different enhancers, where the motif importance, as predicted by DeepStart, correlated very well with the experimentally measured motif importance according to motif mutagenesis. So this was extremely exciting to us, you know, aiming to understand how enhancers work. And we also found and validated this for AP1 twist and TRL motifs in Drosophila S2 cell enhancers and also in human enhancers of the colon cancer cell line HCT116. But how could this possibly work? How could motifs that spell out identically at the DNA sequence level have such different contributions to enhancer activities? Bernardo essentially found two clear rules. One is that the motif's flanks between important and non-important motifs differed, so the sequence is directly adjacent to the motifs, something that also Emma Farley and Mike Levine had observed for different enhancer system. And also, more excitingly for me, because I actually failed to see such an effect during my postdoc, Bernardo also uncovered an effect of motif-motif spacing. For this, and I go into a little more detail here, for this he embedded two motif instances next to each other at different distances, and then basically asked whether the motifs were predicted to have additive behavior, just then they would be here along this line at one, or whether they had synergistic behavior, then they would basically, the predictions would be more up here. And in this case, for motif ETS-SRAPP pair, you see that there was strong synergy at closer distances, but then at around 25 nucleotides distant, these two motifs were essentially additive. This is maybe expected because close motifs can lead to transcription factors binding at the protein level. But Bernardo found also two other modes. One mode that he, for example, observed for a GADA-GADA motif pair that was more synergistic at longer distances and with a sharp drop towards closer distances. And then a more continuous behavior that he, for example, observed for AP1 and GADA motif pairs that started out with higher synergy and then the synergy more gradually dropped. Again, this was very exciting, teaching us for the first time about such motif distance rules. And so we wanted to test this experimentally. And together with Fanny again, Bernardo selected GADA-GADA motifs that were either close and predicted to have no synergy or distal predicted to have synergy, and then they mutated them. And as expected from the prediction, mutating GADA motifs that were close led to a lower drop in activity, while mutating motifs that were more distal and thus exhibited synergy led to a higher drop in activity. And for AP1 GADA, where this behavior should be reversed, it was indeed reversed, with now the closer motifs leading to a stronger drop in activity. So this was extremely exciting because with a combination of high throughput enhanced activity measurements and deep learning, we could not only predict enhanced activities directly from the DNA sequence, but we could also investigate motif syntax rules, such as, again, rules about motif flanks and motif-motif spacing. And we were now wondering whether these rules that we uncovered, and in particular also the models that we trained, were good enough to design synthetic enhancers de novo. And so for this, Barnardo scored random DNA sequences with his DeepStar model and selected sequences, unnatural sequences that don't occur in nature, that were predicted to be either weak, of medium strength, or strong. Then we synthesized them and measured their enhancer activities in S2 cells by Starseq. And what was extremely amazing was that these synthetic enhancers behaved essentially as designed, with the weak ones being extremely weak, and then their activity increased up to the cohort of the strong enhancers that were partly stronger than the wild-type enhancers that I again show here in red. And the coolest thing was that we could now look at the very strongest synthetic enhancer and at its sequence. And basically, the computer selected a sequence that perfectly adhered to the rules that I just described to you, namely that GADA motifs that like to be distal were also more distal, and motifs like AP1 GADA or ETS-AP1 that have a positive synergistic effect when close, they were also close. So for enhancer systems for which we can measure enhancer activities in large quantities, for example, genome-wide, we can now, and I can say this with confidence, model enhancer activities using these deep learning model, and this is also true for enhancers in mammalian cells for which such large data sets are available. But if we go back to these enhancer activities that we are so fascinated about in vivo, that trace different organ systems and drive development, I told you before that for these we just don't have enough training data to directly train such predictive or generative models. But in the meantime, Barnardo had an idea, and he argued that potentially he could achieve this goal through a stepping stone approach. So he argued that a method used widely in machine learning called transfer learning would initially train a model on a related task for which a lot of training data is available, and then adjust this model to the actual task on a much smaller data set. And the textbook example for this transfer learning is the recognition of cats, for which you have very few images to train, but you have a lot of dog images, so you can pre-train the model to recognize dogs, and once the model gets really good in predicting dogs in images, it's then much easier to retrain the model to predict cats. So now we don't talk about cats and dogs here, we talk about enhancers. So a genome-wide data set that could serve as a very good stepping stone, we argued, is a TaxSeq, or more specifically single-cell TaxSeq, which is now widely available, and as we heard in Mira's talk or in the question-answer session, is closely related to enhancer activity, but of course open, accessible open regions are not exactly enhancers, but they could serve many other functions. So we thought as a stepping stone this could be very good, and we teamed up with Eileen Furlong's lab, who at the time had just performed single-cell TaxSeq for the 10 to 12 hour old Drosophila embryo, revealing at the single-cell resolution level the accessible DNA for many different tissues, including, for example, the central nervous system, epidermis, different muscle tissues, the gut, and so forth. Now, to stay at the tissue level resolution, Barnardo collapsed the individual cells of a particular tissue into what we call pseudobulks. So these are essentially cell type pure models of the respective tissue. Here I show, for example, the central nervous system and the somatic muscle as collapsed from these two single cell cohorts. And then we have a data structure, these genomic tracks that we know very well how to model. And indeed, with the same DeepStar approach that he used for StarSeq data, he can model these ataxic tracks very well with Pearson correlation coefficients exceeding 0.7. So we essentially, and again, this was no surprise because other people had shown even back in 2016 that ataxic data can be modeled. We had successfully taken this first step towards our stepping stone. So subsequently, Bernardo basically now took this model that we call the DNA to accessibility model and adjusted or fine-tuned it to now directly from the DNA sequence predict enhancer activities. And again, we chose for in this case four different tissues, the central nervous system, the epidermis, the gut, and the muscle. And he then used left out sequences to cross-validate whether the model correctly predicted activities, and he used enhancers that were not seen during training, but also negative sequences, both with and without ataxic signals to rigorously test the model. And for those of you who are into machine learning, the way that we now look at the cross-validation is a bit unusual. So we don't look at the average performance that you might normally do, but we look at what's called the positive predicted value, namely how many or which fraction of the predicted enhancers at a certain threshold are active. So we're going from poor prediction scores to high prediction scores. And you see that at high prediction scores, we have above 50 or sometimes even above 75% of the predicted enhancers active. So these are the data for the central nervous system, so the brain and the ventral nerve cord. And we found similar positive predictive value for the epidermis, while for the gut and for the muscle, they were somewhat lower at 35% or 25%. But still in a range where we felt confident to design enhancers based on these models, arguing that if these cross-validation results hold, then somewhere between 1 in 3 or 4 to maybe 1 in 4 enhancers should be active. So Bernardo went back to his enhancer design strategy, again scoring random sequences with the different DeepStar models to select enhancers that were predicted to be accessible and also active in the central nervous system, the epidermis, the muscle, and the gut. Then he teamed up with Michi in our lab to clone these synthetic sequences together with the HSP70 minimal promoter and the LUXE reporter gene. And we had a company, Best Gene, enter these constructs into a constant landing site, into the Drosophila genome, and then send these flies to Eileen's lab so that Christoph in Eileen's lab could evaluate whether the enhancers were active or not. And he did this always in comparison to tissue-specific marker genes, such as LRV for the central nervous system. And I guess I wouldn't be so excited if this didn't work. So surprisingly, it worked actually very well, where we did 8, because remember, 25% success rate expected for the muscle. We wanted to not have 1, but 2. But in fact, the success was much better, so we had 8 out of the 8 enhancers worked for the CNS, 7 out of the 8 for the epidermis. In gut, it was much lower, as expected, at 2 out of 8, but in muscle, actually much better than expected, again, at 8 out of 8. And most of the enhancers were also specific to the respective tissue, so only 2 out of the 8 central nervous system enhancers were also somewhat active in the peripheral nervous system, so closely related tissue, and 1 of the 2 gut enhancers was active in the amnera serosa, another tissue that was also rich in GATA motifs. So we're, I think, as a field, we have entered a time where we can computationally predict and design enhancers. So here you see the full data set of all the different enhancer classes. These are, as I said, synthetic DNA sequences as they do not occur in nature, and yet they can be correctly interpreted by the embryo. You can imagine that this is now extremely exciting. So I know of many groups that now apply these methods to their favorite model. These are just some colleagues and friends that collaborate with us on topics as diverse as mouse enhancers, regeneration enhancers, transposons, or cancer. And as I said, I think these are very exciting times for our field of enhancer sequences, the topic of today's colloquium. I already mentioned this. It's kind of the summary of today, but also the outlook. We can now, with large enough genome-wide data sets, we can predict enhancers. We can use transfer learning to even go into in vivo enhancer activities. We can evaluate these models to learn also as biologists and scientists what enhancers need to be active. And I think that we will see a lot of cool advance in the next few years. So with this, I want to thank the people who did the work. I mentioned the heroes all throughout the talk. This is the group in Vienna currently. I want to thank the collaborators, a key collaboration here, Eileen Furlong and her group, Stefano and Christoph, the all other collaborators, our services, the IMP of the VBC in Vienna, has really wonderful scientific services without which we couldn't do the work, all colleagues, wonderful community, the funders, and you for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You talked about training the network with you know, dark faces to recognize cats, which, you know, is a classic in the image recognition business. But if you think ahead and you know, you think of using synthetic enhancer for therapeutic use in, you know, in 10 years, 20 years, you would need to train your system to respond to different metabolic situation, age situation, environmental conditions. Mm-hmm. How are you going to train the network with this? Do you think it's going to be necessary to have every single cell of the body at different age in different conditions to train the network correctly?
So we, Denis likes to challenge people. I need to think of a good answer. So what I think the models are extremely powerful at is, given training data, even if they come from idealized conditions, of what we, for example, do with Anna Obenhof, I mentioned her name briefly, is that we take a cancer model through the process of becoming therapy resistant. That's basically what her work focuses on. And then we try to derive models and rules for this process to then design sequences that do not occur in nature, but that can be perfect indicators of which phase of this transition we're currently at. So that is kind of the cool thing, that you can look into the human genome in this case and learn rules and then create sequences that never exist in the human genome, but perfectly exploit these rules to be exactly active when you want them to be active and not otherwise.
Well, thank you very, very much, Alex, for... it's time to close this meeting. I hope you all enjoyed it as much as I did. I learned a lot, and that was so cool. Let me thank really all the speakers to come here, to stay here, participate. Let me thank Séverine Frima, who organized the whole logistic and administration. Let me thank the technical staff behind the windows. They will care about depositing the lectures on the website of the Collège de France. So if you missed some, if you like to relax and try to understand convolution, you still have a chance. And well, thank you all for coming and for staying. See you next year, hopefully.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.